Today on New Horizons, Boise State history professor Barton Barber offers a fresh look at an icon of the American West in his new book, Jedediah Smith, No Ordinary Mountain Man.
Fur traders, including Jedediah Smith, were advancing nationalistic expansionist goals at a time when the United States Army had no ability to move through the plains effectively. My argument here and elsewhere is that the fur trade in North America could be seen as the first truly modern global business. Though he had lots of hair-raising experiences, he was connected with his men in a very dense set of ways, and he wasn't a solitary explorer.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. The iconic image of the American West mountain men and fur traders is often the stuff of legend. As trailblazers, they opened up the continent for the millions who eventually settled the wilderness west of the Mississippi. These rugged individuals also provided the young country with a model for the self-reliance that remains part of its collective mentality today. Among the few names still familiar to us from this particular breed of adventure is Jedediah Smith. The first white man to travel overland to California via the Southwest, Smith is said to have roamed through more of the West than any of his peers. Today's guest, historian and Boise State history professor Barton Barber, offers a fresh look at this important historical figure in his new book, Jedediah Smith, No Ordinary Mountain Man. Dr. Barber's research portrays the legendary trapper as a man concerned not only with adventure, but also with business obligations and his comrades' welfare. His book also takes a hard look at Smith's dealings with American Indians, Mexicans in California, and Hudson Bay Company competitors. Dr. Barber received his Ph.D. from the University of New Mexico, Albuquerque. He teaches courses in colonial America, Native American history, and U.S. Indian policy and North American exploration. He has published 5 books and several articles, most of which deal with the history of the North American fur trade. Barton Barber, welcome back to New Horizons.
Thank you very much.
Well, Bart, let's start with your subtitle, the fact that this guy, Jedediah Smith, is no ordinary mountain man. So may we begin with just who is the ordinary mountain man, and then how does Jedediah differ from him?
Well, the ordinary mountain men in what is usually seen as the classic Rocky Mountain fur trade era that runs from 1825 to 1840, most of those guys who are mountain men, or mountaineers as they called themselves, are about the same age as Smith. Some are literate, some are not. Most of them came from frontier circumstances like Smith, and yet what sets Jedediah Smith apart from them is his literacy, his education, his agile and acute mind, and his absolute compulsion and fascination for exploration and for writing. And so for these reasons, he's like them, but he's also different from them. He also has a much more austere personality than we usually associate with flamboyant characters of the Rocky Mountain era, like Joseph Meek or Jim Bridger or Kit Carson even.
I suppose the fact that he was so literate compared to his counterparts is the reason we're even here today and the reason you're able to do the book, because didn't you rely in, to some extent, on journals that he actually wrote in accounting for his travels?
Yes, I did. Smith is a rare bird in that sense, too, because he was a journalist. Part of the reason for his journaling, as one might say, is that he was just fascinated with recording things. But there's a larger story there, and that's about his desire, a real highly motivated desire, to write a travelogue of his adventures in the West and get it published along with some maps that he drew, because he was a fantastic cartographer as well. And he knew, he was very much aware that he was seeing things that nobody else had seen. He felt it was important to record these things. And his journals do provide the core for my book. Some of those journals were known early in the 20th century. Other elements, very important ones, didn't appear until almost 1970. And so these things collectively, with letters he wrote and so on, and letters about him, provide the documentary basis for this book and allows me to use his voice as much as I can, which I really tried to focus on to get a sense of who this guy was so that people could read it for themselves.
Since he did write so much, was he better known in his day as a mountain man than most, or did all of these writings come to light later after his passing?
He never did live long enough to publish his book, and that created a huge mysterious gap in the literature. In his own day, he was well known for what he had done, partly because of his own operations and also because of his important associations with businessmen and politicians in St. Louis. So altogether, he was a pretty well-known and certainly highly respected fellow in his own day. But the sort of mythic ideas of what we think of as Jedediah Smith's personality today, and for that matter, the details of his journeys, were not really a part of the public record, so to speak, in his own day, and they only surfaced much later.
We might take a moment for those of us here in Idaho who know the work of Vardis Fischer. He wrote a book called Mountain Man, I believe it was, and it was based on the life of John Johnson, and that's the book that then Robert Redford portrayed Jeremiah Johnson in the movie. And there was a moment there when I saw the title of your book, and I think I did what a number of people do. I confused the two. This is not Jeremiah Johnson. In fact, my recollection of that movie is a pretty solitary character. And as I read your account of Jedediah Smith, I read about a guy who is more of a social being. I mean, maybe I missed this, but how would you describe the difference between the characterization of Vardis Fischer and the real life Jedediah Smith, who was a different guy?
Right. Fisher's book was dealing, you know, his central issue was truly rugged individualism. Jeremiah Johnson is a fabricated character based on a character named Liver Eaton Johnson. And he has all these travails in his life. His wife gets killed and he has to, you know, he goes out and murders lots of Indians and stuff. And so it's really man against nature in the wilderness and everything in the wilderness, which is peculiar in that since Sidney Pollack or whoever wrote the screenplay used Jeremiah, it led to a great deal of confusion. And I heard you say it as well. I've done it myself. I have heard Zebediah, Jerediah. I've heard Jeremiah. I've heard so many names for this guy that it's really quite astounding. And there is a huge difference between Fisher's character and the actual Jedediah Smith, who, though he had lots of hair-raising experiences and really horrible experiences, he also was a man who was a sort of natural-born leader, and therefore he was connected with his men in a very dense set of ways, and he wasn't a solitary explorer.
Mm-hmm. Now, I hate to go to the end of the story, but since you chose to do that, I guess it's okay for me to do it. I was somewhat surprised that you open up your book with this very intriguing scene that leads to the death of Jedediah Smith right off the bat. And I'm thinking, my gosh, he's just told the end of the story, and it's almost a prologue. But it's about the fact that at a very young age, was he 31? He goes off and runs into these Comanches, and they kill him. And how accurate can we be about the details of that murder?
That's a good question, and the answer is not entirely accurate because so little is known. Let me explain for people that don't know what happened very briefly. Smith is on a Santa Fe trail. They run out of water. He goes out searching for water, and that's it. His friends never see him again. He's dead and left on the desert. When his friends and the caravan he traveled with included two of his brothers, when they got to Santa Fe, which was a couple of weeks later, they ran into some New Mexican traders who allegedly possessed some of Smith's possessions. And from those traders, his brothers and his associates got a sketchy summary of what might have happened. And so that in itself was a little less information than we might like to have. I also discovered in one of the obituaries that was published about Smith a little bit of information that suggested to me that I could rewrite or try and firm up a little bit of the situation that did take place when he was killed. And so it's somewhat speculative, but it's not entirely made up.
Now, he was an explorer. He was a cartographer. He was a trapper. I'm interested in the trapping end of the business and the mechanics of trapping. I'm fascinated by how does a guy out there in the middle of nowhere trap? What does he trap? How many can he trap before he gets to the point of sale? How profitable is this business? is this a really, truly, I mean, and you talk about this in your book, of course, a profitable business and makes people wealthy?
It does on a limited basis. Let's start with the mechanics aspect. The way this was organized, and Smith has a lot to do with this, in fact, it's what was called the brigade system of trapping. So you'd have a leader like Smith, who was sometimes called a bourgeois or a partisan, and he would have 20 to 30 or 40 or 50 guys working for him, broken into squads. Each trapper generally had six traps, and they'd go out and set the traps in the morning, pick them up at night. Camp keepers would skin the animals, and then they would rudimentarily process the furs and pack them into bags.
Beaver primarily?
Primarily beaver, because beaver fur was used in the hat trade, and that was its number one application. But they were also hunting for mink or ermine or otters and other prime high-end furs. The way that it then worked was they would collect these packs of fur, curate them, as it were, until they were headed back either to St. Louis or, in Smith's era, thanks to William Ashley, who inaugurates what's called the rendezvous system. This was a central location in the Rockies where supplies would be taken out from St. Louis to the Rockies. Furs were collected at a point in the Rockies and then either hauled on wagons or horses or sometimes in river boats. Like keel boats or bull boats or what have you, back down the river to St. Louis, from which they were then sent on to Philadelphia or New Orleans or New York or Montreal, and then they entered the world fur market.
The global economy.
It really was a global economy, and my argument here and elsewhere is that the fur trade in North America could be seen as the first truly modern global business. Now, in terms of profits, the fur trade, in terms of its percentage of the GNP in the 1830s, for example, or the 20s, didn't amount to more than 6 or 7% of the GNP. So economically, it's relatively small. For example, trading hemp from the Mississippi Valley was more profitable than the fur trade. But trading hemp did not extend exploration, and the fur trade did that. And that was one of the things that made it so terribly important in the early 19th century. Is that the fur traders were out doing things that the government couldn't or wouldn't do, and yet they were working kind of hand in glove with the government. Just as an example, when you think about Jedediah Smith, he spends about 10 years in the West, which is basically about three times as long, for example, as Lewis and Clark spent in the West. And so this guy really does know what he's looking at, and that makes him important, partly because he's willing and able to convey that information to businessmen, politicians, and others back in St. Louis and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Lewis and Clark, didn't he take some routes that were actually taken first by him? Was it the Oregon Trail that he actually traversed before the Oregon Trail became popular as the Oregon Trail?
That's right. One of the main contributions of the Rocky Mountain fur trade era in terms of national expansionism is that they developed what they called in the 1820s the Platte River Road, which basically left the Missouri at or near Council Bluffs and followed the Platte westward up to the point at which in 1834 Fort Laramie would be built. A few years later, that route became a primary element of the California and Oregon Trail. And one of the reasons why Smith is so important is because in 1824, he is credited with being what's called the effective rediscoverer of the South Pass. And that was the key to the westward movement on the California and Oregon Trail after 1840. And so there is a definite relationship between what the mountain men were doing and the later ability of nearly 300,000 Americans to cross the plains on wagons before the railroad era.
And the advantage of the South Pass is that it was not as rugged and as cold as the North Pass, which Lewis and Clark took over the Idaho-Montana border.
Exactly, and that's why it's called the South Pass, as opposed to the Northern Pass of Lewis and Clark, which was the low trail and through Montana and Idaho that was very, very difficult and challenging. Whereas, by contrast, the South Pass is a easy traverse of the Continental Divide, and once you're west of the South Pass, you can find your way to California with relative ease.
You're listening to Barton Barber. He is a Boise State history professor, and he has written a book, Jedediah Smith, No Ordinary Mountain Man. back to his education. Again, you mentioned we don't know much about his first 18 years, but why was this guy so well-educated? How did he get his education? He was from New York, as I understand it, right?
That's right. He was born in a place that was then called Jericho, New York. Now it's called Bainbridge. Just a bit of background here. His family originally came to North America in the 1630s as part of the Puritan migration to Massachusetts Bay. And so this is a purely a British American family with great ancestral roots. In the course of the late 18th and early 19th century, Jedediah's father moved west himself three or four times from Vermont through New York to Pennsylvania to Ohio, and they had moved several times, so they really are a Western family. Also, I presume their Puritan roots provided some impetus for education, and the long and the short of it is, even though he was a rural frontier boy who grew up basically in poverty, he made a connection with a fellow named Dr. Titus Vespasian Simons, who was a well-educated medical man who took an interest in educating local boys in Jericho, New York, one of whom was Jedediah Smith. So by the time he was probably 15 or 16, he was literate. He had probably been acquainted to some degree with double-entry bookkeeping and other characteristics which would suit him for a life in business. He also, we know from his own journals, he was, as a youngster, really, very interested in exploration history, and he was familiar with the writings of Lewis and Clark and George Vancouver and other characters like that. So even as a youth, as soon as he learned to read, one assumes, he got fired up on exploration literature. And so he was very thankful to Dr. Simons for his education. And in fact, one of Jedediah Smith's sisters married a son of Dr. Simon, so the families were definitely connected for quite a long time.
One of the things that you comment on in various sections of your book is Jedediah Smith's role in national expansionism, and certainly his trip across the West and eventually going into Mexico is a large part of that. Could you help us understand the role that he did play in that and how that really did set up the settling of the West, but more particularly what happened in Mexico? Because clearly he wasn't even supposed to be trapping in Mexico, as I understand federal law at that time. Is that correct?
That's right. The laws that were called the Trade and Intercourse Laws had originated in around 1796, and by the 1820s had been developed into a codified system whereby fur traders and hunters would be licensed, bonded, and so on to do trade with Indians. Among those laws was a stipulation that no game could be taken from Indian country. My reading of that suggests that hunting and trapping were equally illegal, and yet hunting and trapping were the business that these guys were involved in, and so that raises the question, what is going on? Here is my simple explanation for it, that fur traders, including Jedediah Smith, were advancing nationalistic expansionist goals at a time when the United States Army had no ability to move through the plains effectively. In fact, Indians west of the Mississippi River were pretty much not even under the administration in any stretch of the sense of the United States of America. So Smith and the mountain men who go out there into the far west beyond the Mississippi are actually operating illegally, technically, and yet their achievements in terms of geographical knowledge, dealing with Indians, making arrangements, all served national governmental interests. And that, I suspect, in fact, I even have some references to this in my book, that essentially the government chose to wink and nod at the repeated violation of its own laws because interest in the so-called Oregon country was growing very rapidly in the 1820s, and of course that would be consummated in the Mexican-American War of 1826. As Oregon was of interest to Americans, so was Mexican California. And Smith is the first American we know of to travel overland to California. By the time he gets there in 1826, the hide and tallow trade is up and running in California. This is what Richard Henry Daner wrote about in a very famous book. And Smith gets there in time to see that, but he's coming from a different direction with different interests. And so these things all work to sort of boost interest in the West. Just for an example, several Missouri and other newspapers trumpeted the achievements of Smith and the Ashley men and repeatedly claimed how easy it would be for anybody in a wagon to roll out to California. This, of course, wasn't true, but it seemed true. And so all these things work together in the national current of expansionism. Although it's true that when Smith gets to California, he definitely gets in a serious fix.
Right, he sure does. He gets thrown in jail, doesn't he?
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, when it comes to the Mexican governor and his reaction to Jedediah Smith, is the fact that the governor was figuring out the Washington's interest in the far West and assumed perhaps that guys like Jedediah Smith were the precursors to the takeover, the military that would come later?
I think one could say that. There's also a kind of a larger cultural issue in that most Americans of the age of Jackson, the 1820s and 30s, for example, were anti-Catholic, anti-Hispanic. This relates to what's called the Black Legend of the Spanish Conquest. And since Spaniards were Catholics, that's a double whammy. And anything that could be used as a sort of negative assessment of Spaniards, who they usually refer to Mexicans as Spaniards, could be used as an excuse to sort of ignore the protocols of dealing with foreigners when you're an illegal alien, for example. Smith is he is invested in these attitudes, and he faces the problem of what to do with such attitudes when he's actually confronting Mexicans in terms of officials or the governor or soldiers or priests at the missions or what have you. For their part, the Mexican officials had been very nervous. In fact, Spain itself had been quite nervous in the 18th century about the possibility for invasion by the French or the British or later the Americans. So there's a good degree of suspicion and unease among both parties. And, of course, in Mexican California, it turned out there was only a few thousand Hispanic folks there and many thousands more Native Americans. And so the Mexicans were always in a somewhat dicey situation of trying to maintain control. Anything that came in that looked like it might upset that balance was seen as a real problem. And so the governor of New Mexico of California and some of the other officials really did see and spoke of Smith as a Yankee spy. Mm-hmm. And they were very suspicious mm-hmm. of him. He really couldn't explain himself either. And one of the reasons is the Spaniards and Mexicans really didn't have much to do at all with beaver trapping. And so they really couldn't understand what the heck he was looking for beavers for. And that only added to the complexities mm-hmm. of the relationship.
There's a bit of an Idaho connection to this story in that Jedediah Smith manages to touch the southeastern corner of the state around Bear Lake, I think. And then I think there was also, wasn't he up north around Coeur d'Alene or somewhere up in Ponderay area?
Yes, indeed. He travels through the Snake River Plains several times. He even moved right through the Boise area at least once. And this would have been in the 1824 to 26 era. And then after he had made his way the second time he went to California all the way north to the Columbia River, he heads east and then does indeed cross through part of British Columbia, northern Idaho, and Montana as he makes his way back into what is today Wyoming in mm-hmm. 1829.
Mm-hmm. You refer to these large rendezvous meetings of the trappers. I thought, my gosh, that must be precursor to those horrible annual conferences and conventions we have to go to these days. They even did it back then. Help me understand what that's all about.
The rendezvous system is something that is attributed to William Ashley. And the idea is quite simple. Again, it's the idea of bringing goods out to the mountains and taking furs in at the mountains. The purpose is sort of fundamentally to maximize the time that these trappers are spending in the West. If they're moving their furs back and forth, then 6 months of the year is not trapping time. Ashley decides to bring goods out to them to maximize their time. Now, the interesting thing here, and I write this in the book, the word rendezvous, of course, is a French word, which suggests to me that since Ashley was from Virginia, he used the word and he used the concept. In fact, I argue in my book that not only had French Canadians been doing this since the 17th or 18th century, but even in the early 19th century, the Northwest Company and Hudson's Bay companies also used a kind of a rendezvous system in what is today Canada. Usually, their transport system relied on boats. The innovation that Ashley brings to the Rocky Mountain rendezvous system is that he's going to use pack animals and wagons to move the goods, the gear, and the furs around. And so there is some innovation there, and yet I would argue that Ashley adopts rather than invents a system. Nevertheless, it's pretty effective because it did maximize trappers' time in the mountains. And then incidentally, it provided this grand frolic in the mountains, which became so hugely important in the sort of enduring legacy of the hell roarers, the mountain men, the reckless breed of men, or whatever you want to call them. One of the weird aspects of thinking this way is that when the rendezvous system ends in 1840, this is 9 years or so after Smith is killed, many people would argue that the fur trade ends in 1840, but I have written elsewhere, and I would argue that that simply is not so. And so there's a bit of a misconception. All of this leads to this idea that the rendezvous era was the apex moment of the fur trade, and in some ways it was. Although what I would argue is that the rendezvous era was the last time that that kind of system can happen on a blank slate. But it had been happening for centuries already as the fur trade frontier moved west. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that in the 1820s and 30s, what the fur trade frontier consisted of was the interior mountain and plains west of what is today the United States.
My last question, and we have run out of time, though, is to double all the way back to the beginning of this discussion when we were talking about how he died. I didn't ask you, and I believe this is the case, that they never really did find Jedediah Smith's body. So we don't know exactly where he died. I mean, how can we be so sure that it happened where they said it happened among these Comanches?
Right. The actual location of his death is a few scholars researchers have tried to identify places in extreme western Kansas, which is no doubt near where it happened. But since his body was never discovered, that leaves it somewhat unanswerable. But what we do know is the circumstances of his death. That's pretty clear. And furthermore, the situation seems to be that these New Mexican, possibly mixed blood or Hispanic traders that were called Comancheros traded with Comanches and had done so by 1830. They'd been doing this for more than a century. And yet they would be, in my judgment, very unlikely, because it is a risky trade in itself, they would be very unlikely to risk their necks to offer assistance to a total stranger who, among other things, is a gringo, an American. When they saw Smith, and the story seems to be that Comancheros encountered Smith and warned him that Comanches were nearby and he would probably not be able to get away. It was at this point that it is said that Jedediah Smith boldly rode up to the Comanches, and 10 minutes later he was dead. The bits and pieces of the story were conveyed to the surviving members of the caravan weeks later. And so Smith's death is something of a mystery, which only it's all part of the difficulties of doing a biography of this character, about whom little is known in a lot of points of his life and a lot is known about 10 years of his life.
Right.
And so I tried to compare this to, if you were into revolutionary era history, you'd want to pick somebody like Alexander Hamilton to write a biography about. Well, the documentation is voluminous. With Smith, it's a very different story, and yet he's a terribly important guy, so one has to do the best with the sources one has at hand.
And you did just that, Bart. I really do appreciate your coming on the show today. Dr. Barton Barber, the author of Jedediah Smith, No Ordinary Mountain Man, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, my guest is author and screenwriter Jay Perini, whose novel The Last Station is a fascinating study of the end of Russian author Leo Tolstoy's life and the subject of a new movie by our own Michael Hoffman, titled the same, The Last Station. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer for this show is Mike Journey. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.